You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 FM in Asheville and streaming across the universe at radioasheville.org. Thank you so much for supporting your local community radio. We couldn't do it without you.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And we are fortunate to have with us today Professor Josh Horowitz. He is the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions and the Dana Feitler Professor in Gun Violence Prevention and Advocacy. He works to reduce gun violence by utilizing public health research and analysis to build advocacy campaigns that meet critical opportunities in the policy development process. He holds his law degree from George Washington University. Josh Horowitz, welcome to A Better World.
McNair, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Just recently, on July 19th here in Asheville, there was a mass shooting incident where two people died, seven were injured, and as far as I know, the suspect or suspects are still at large. So I want to thank you for coming on the show to talk about the work of the Center for Gun Violence Solutions. Could we start by just telling us a bit about the history of the center and how and when did it start?
Well, the Center at Johns Hopkins has been around for over 25 years, and we've always done in our center really quality and cutting-edge research on looking at the solutions, doing policy-relevant research on gun violence and understanding what drives gun violence, but also what the solutions are. I actually spent most of my career in another nonprofit called the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence, where I worked on policy campaigns, I worked on legal campaigns, media campaigns in the nonprofit world, working on gun violence prevention. I've always had a foot in the door at Hopkins because I teach public health advocacy there. But 2022, I had an opportunity to become part of the Hopkins team because as much as they did great research, we wanted to make that research work in the world. We wanted to do more advocacy around the research. And there was no opportunity to become the Dana Feitler Professor. And I interviewed and I took that job. But the thing that we did that was different is that we really merged the Ed Fund into the Hopkins Center. So we have a much larger center now. It absolutely focuses on research. So we think about we think in our center, public health is what drives everything. Gun violence is still a public health emergency. The second thing is that our own objective and nonpartisan research drives whatever we do. This is not, and our research is what our North Star. We focus on what we do on that research, but then we develop advocacy campaigns and we have all the tools of public health advocacy. We have a great communications team. We've got a legal team. We do research translation. And then we have an advocacy team that goes out and talks with legislators, educates them, educates decision makers about what the facts are. That's what drives us is the facts. But our goal is to put the facts into people's hands who can make decisions at the appropriate time. And it's been a great experience growing our center in the last 4 years. And so that's the origins and the history of the center. And we've been involved in some of the most cutting edge research out there, for instance, about firearm purchase or licensing. But also we're involved now in working in the field to make sure that the people who need to make the decisions, whether that's a legislator, whether that's a regulator, whether that might even be a corporation executive, they have the information, they have the facts that they need to make a good decision about how to prevent gun violence.
Well, speaking of research, I saw that the center receives funding from NIH and CDC. Has your center been affected any by the cuts that have come to those organizations lately?
Yeah, the university overall has been affected, and obviously but fortunately the center's research continues, and we've been able to do the research that we were set out to do. So we're grateful for that. We're grateful for the support of those institutions as well as the support of our own university.
So what is it about the gun violence subject and area that interests you, that got you started in it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, it's kind of personal and kind of sad. So I don't talk about this a lot, but I will just mention that, as you mentioned at the beginning, I'm an attorney, and I practiced in a civil rights firm when I left law school. And I, you know, it was a great job. But unfortunately, a dear friend and colleague at the firm died by firearm suicide after my first year there. And from that, I sort of trying to understand how could this person have a firearm? How prevalent was firearm suicides? And I learned that it turns out firearm suicides is extremely prevalent. It's preventable too. And so I found this job at the educational fund and I took it. And I thought maybe I'd leave private practice for 2 years and go back. But it's been really the passion of my life. So I started that way. And then, you know, I've seen that the work we do makes a huge difference in changing policy and doing education work. So I love that. But I also, you know, in my line of work, McNair, I met hundreds, thousands of survivors, people who have been shot themselves, people who have lost loved ones to homicide and suicide, and mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters who have just an aching hole in their heart. And I stay in this and I keep doing this because of that. And I feel that that's why I do it. And it's a big motivator. And I really don't want to let those families down. And I think the other aspect of is this is an interest is sort of intellectually interesting, but it also allows you to put that intellect to good use. You can think about a problem, you can understand the problem, then you can go out in the field and try to solve that problem. So really, for a lot of those reasons, I stay involved and I'll continue to stay involved.
So what are some of the statistics that you think it might be helpful for people to know about? I know statistics can make people blurry-eyed if they hear too much of them, but can you share what you think might be important for people listening?
Well, I think the probably the most important thing, and I don't know that people know this, and so we'll start here and sort of nationally, and then I'm going to talk a little bit locally, if you don't mind. But our center analyzes the Center for Disease Control firearm mortality data when it comes out. Now, it lags, so we're still 2 years behind, but we just finished our 2024 report. You can go to our website, just Google Center for Gun Violence Solutions, and this report will pop up so you can see it, and you can see the data behind it. So in 2024, 44,447 people died from gun violence. That is one person in this country every 12 minutes. The other piece that I want people to understand is that we tend to think of gun violence often as a homicide problem. But as I mentioned before, gun suicide is very prevalent. So most, in fact, about two-thirds or about 60% of those gun deaths are suicide. So over 27,000 people die from gun suicide in America every single year. And people don't realize that. And while we've heard some headlines about gun violence going down, and it has reduced in many places, in some places significantly, but this gun suicide rate is still in 2024, the highest number ever recorded. And because that's personal to me, I want people to understand that every 19 minutes in this country, someone dies by gun suicide. So I can go on and we can talk more about North Carolina, but I'll just take a break if you have questions about that.
I was interested in one statistic that said the gun homicide rate for Black females from 2015 to 2024 rose by 63%. What's behind that number?
Well, I don't know. We don't know for sure, but I can say that during the pandemic, gun ownership in certain communities went up, and that probably includes in the African American community. And we do know, and the suicide numbers have gone up even more dramatically. And so we do know that, you know, access to firearms certainly drives firearm suicide and plays a role in firearm homicide. And we've seen communities that historically might not have owned firearms at the same rate, bought a lot of guns during the pandemic, and that drove up the death rate in those communities.
You mentioned before the show, I believe it was, that you had some information to share about trends in North Carolina. Can you speak to that?
I can. And it's very interesting. So in North Carolina, just some basic, what we call basic epidemiology, you've had 1,835 gun deaths in 2024 in North Carolina. 98 young people from the ages of 1 to 17 were killed. And that means that in North Carolina, on average, someone dies from guns every 5 hours. And you asked about gun violence increase. We can see that in North Carolina, gun death rate increased 29%. If you look at when you compare 2024 to 2015, you just asked about that. North Carolina has the 12th highest gun homicide rate in the country. A number of states, gun violence has gone down. That's not true in North Carolina. Gun violence, if you look over the last 10 years, gun violence in North Carolina has gone up. And I think it's gone up. There's been a sort of rise in recent gun deaths as well. So it doesn't surprise me that you saw a tragedy in North Carolina. That is not unusual in the state.
I know there's probably a lot of factors that enter into people resorting to gun violence, but does the Center for Gun Violence Solutions ever look into such things as the effects, social, educational, economic determinants, and whether this has an effect on someone's inclination to gun violence?
Sure. It's not necessarily someone's inclination, but it really affects community trends, right? So, I can't speak to anybody's individual motivation, but you can see, we do research in our center. We have a lot of great researchers, but Mudia Uzia from our center has done research showing that, for instance, when community schools close down, it seems to affect the homicide rate. Historic redlining, people preventing African-Americans from buying certain neighborhoods or redlining their neighborhoods so that their property values go down, affects gun violence. And we know that society, like income and poverty and education, those are big issues as well. And there's a lot of research outside the center as well that shows, that the environmental factors, right, the upstream factors, the social determinants of health, can affect gun violence. And so all of these work together. My work tends to focus on sort of the policy and programmatic side of these things, but our center as a whole looks at all of that, and they all work together. And one of the reasons when people say, "Oh, well, what's driving this or what's driving that?" It's actually pretty complex, because you have to unwind the social determinants, or look what the social determinants are, look at what the law changes are. It's actually, it's complex. We pride ourselves in the center in doing complex research, and we can find some of those drivers. But the answer of, in any given year, why gun violence moved up or down is complicated. But we're, that's okay. We're not afraid of complicated. But that's what our research tries to show.
And looking at some of your past research, one of your areas of interest is mental health, and that you've done research related to mental health and gun violence. And can you talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, well, we do research there, but I really work with my collaborator, Jeff Swanson, at Duke University, who's done a huge amount of work in this space. And some of the seminal work that he has done is showing that when it comes to interpersonal gun violence, like, for instance, homicide, that while mental health can be a driver of gun violence, and certainly it is in some cases, it's a relatively small portion of the gun violence that we see across the country. So when you think about, a lot of folks say, well, if we just deal with mental illness, we can solve gun violence. That's definitely not true. It will be better. We should spend more money on mental illness. Mental health and illness does play a role in gun violence. But overall, some of his research shows, for instance, that interpersonal gun violence, if we took mental health out as a factor, you'd still have, 96% of the violence that we have. So that doesn't mean that we shouldn't focus on mental illness. It's very important. In my work in extreme risk protection orders, we might want to talk about, but definitely that comes up a lot. But I don't want to scapegoat people living with mental illness as the driver of gun violence. There are 1 in 5 Americans deal with a mental illness every year. They're not violent. A small little piece of them, piece of people who have mental illness are violent. Our role is to identify who might be violent and intervene in those cases, rather than stigmatize everybody who has mental illness. There are lots of people who have mental illness who can safely handle firearms, but we need to identify those, and there could be other risk factors as well, right? It could be mental illness and substance abuse and other things that are coming together. So So when we think about risk for mental illness, we need to do a very individualized look because, you know, we don't want to stigmatize 20% of our country.
Yes, thank you for pointing that out. I think that's important for people to know about. And when we come back from the break, I'd like for you to kind of speak to the advocacy work of the Center for Gun Violence Solution, if you would. Sure. And if you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Josh Horowitz. He's the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. Okay, that's Hauser and the London Symphony Orchestra playing Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber. And our guest today on A Better World is Josh Horowitz, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. Josh, can you talk about the advocacy aspect of the center's work?
Sure, absolutely. I'm really proud of the work we do. And I'm also proud of the fact that it's nonpartisan, that we work with anybody who would like to learn from us. And so we're across the board. But when you think about advocacy, advocacy is obviously taking a stand in favor of something. But really what an advocate is, and to my teaching, I think about this a lot, but advocacy is more than just doing research or even just policy relevant research. It's taking it off the shelf. It's taking it out of the journal, and it's educating people who are decision makers who might not otherwise have access to that information. And might have lots of other conflicting information. So, for instance, there was a historic change in Virginia's gun laws in the last legislative session in 2026. And we have I live in Virginia, so I'll just say that, but there's a very short legislative session. You have to do a lot of work in a very short time. The legislature was able to pass and the governor signed these 22 new bills looking at gun violence prevention, and they included a whole slew of safe storage laws. They included limitations on assault weapons. They included liability standards for the gun industry. And so we were able to change and really, I think, make it easier for victims of domestic violence to get protective orders and get protection from firearms from people that might try to harm them. So it was a historic year. Our job there is to take the research that we've done on domestic violence, for instance, that we've done on safe storage, and make sure the people who are making decisions in the Virginia legislature have the opportunity to understand what the data says. So that's just an example of the way we work in Virginia. And we will, you know, we're answering questions all the time. We are providing, what's called nonpartisan analysis, where we're giving all the facts there. But we do that on a regular basis. And we might do that. We are called to testify frequently in legislatures, and we do that. We're asked, there's a number of states that are working on firearm purchaser licensing. Our team has done a tremendous amount of work on that law, and we will often take the information that we have for that state. What would firearm purchaser licensing mean? What might, for instance, if the state had that law, how many lives might have been saved over the 10 years prior? So we really do some sophisticated analysis, and we want people to understand fully, transparently what the data says. And also sometimes there are times when our data shows this law may have no effect, right? But we want people to understand all the different things that we do, and we interact directly with decision makers. We are nonpartisan. We don't get involved in politics, and we don't get involved in elections. But when it comes to people making decisions about policy, we want people to have the facts. So we really engage in that, and frequently we'll do that There might be requests for information. We might testify. We might write an op-ed about the research, but it's always the research focus, research forward. That's our role. You won't find us doing, you know, mass persuasion emails and things like that. Mm-hmm. We don't do that. What we do is we bring facts to decision makers at key and critical moments.
I saw on the, if I could just list, there's five policy and program priorities of the center that enter into yes. your advocacy work. One is supporting states to pass firearm purchaser licensing laws, passing firearm removal laws, safe and secure gun storage, addressing community gun violence, and supporting strong public carry laws. How did the center come up with those five things as priorities?
Well, I probably should have said this at the beginning, but our goal is to reduce gun violence 30% by 2030. And when we think about what might get us there, those are what we call the five that save lives. The ones you just mentioned, if you also need to add community violence intervention programming and especially funding. But when you take those five together, we think that's the path to reduce gun violence by 30%. Now, there are lots of other pieces that are important, but we think that if you really had a focus on what should I be doing now, what should state legislators doing now, what should federal policymakers do now, focus on those five will save lives in a meaningful way, and they're all research-based. This is not like, oh, we think this might reduce gun violence, or we feel this might reduce gun violence. We've done a lot of analysis. We've looked at states that have adopted these policies. We've seen the life-saving effects, which is why we feel confident saying these five save lives.
Is there one or two of these issues that are most important right now to address, and if adequately addressed, would make the greatest difference in the level of gun violence?
Well, let's talk about what something that might affect North Carolina, because firearm purchaser licensing, we think, is the single, probably the single most effective policy lever that state lawmakers have. We have done a fair amount of analysis of states that have done this. We've seen dramatic drops in suicide and homicide and police violence and gun trafficking. It is a very effective policy. Unfortunately, North Carolina recently repealed their licensing, their firearm purchaser licensing law. And while we don't have full analysis, looking at the preliminary numbers in 2025, looking at the trends in North Carolina aren't going the right way. We certainly haven't identified the causal mechanism of that, but there's no doubt that they've relaxed their gun law. Your state has relaxed their gun laws in the last 2 years, and we think that may actually be one of the driving factors. But we're not sure yet, but we're going to be certainly looking at that.
So what does that mean, gun licensing?
It's actually a pretty simple process. It means that you must get a license prior to purchasing a firearm, and that license has a number of factors. But here are the factors that we think are important. Number one is the licensing process itself is generally takes, it can, you know, in Maryland where I live, it's not where we work, not live, I live in Virginia, but I work in Maryland. In Maryland that has licensing, it's a very short process, but it does create a small cooling off period. So if someone, you know, is buying a gun to do something nefarious or maybe harm themselves, there's an opportunity to sort of, you know, let whatever driver of violence is mitigate over time. And then we're talking under 10 days. We're not talking a long time. But in those 10 days, what happens is you get fingerprinted, you interact with law enforcement and you or some state agency to get an application, you do your application, fingerprinted, an enhanced background check. Okay, so that means there's time for law enforcement to do a thorough background check. You know, some of the listeners may not know this, but we have a federal background check system in the United States. It doesn't apply to all gun sales. So license, and that is because if you buy a gun outside of a federal firearms licensee, which is like a gun store, so there are many places, North Carolina is one, where you can buy a gun without a background check. Firearm purchaser licensee means everybody gets a background check. Everybody gets a good background check with adequate time for law enforcement to really check those records. If you're just relying on the federal system, if the federal system can't identify and disqualify you in 3 days, you get the gun anyway, even if there's a flag in your system that can't be resolved. And you may recall one state over, the shooter at the in the terrible church shooting in South Carolina, right, in Charleston, that shooter was in the process of what's called a default proceed. They shouldn't have had the gun. local law enforcement couldn't identify there's an arrest that they needed to clarify and what was included in there, but that shooter should never have had a gun. Firearm purchaser licensing eliminates that problem because it gives law enforcement the time they need to thoroughly resolve the background check. There's also fingerprints, as I mentioned, which are a more thorough background check because some of our systems actually have biometrics. So if you have a common name, if you're using an alias, the fingerprints will catch you on that. And also that whole process creates a short cooling off period or background or waiting period, which we think actually can be very effective, especially for people contemplating suicide. Suicidal ideation can be gone in an hour, right? But if you have to give someone immediate access, people can die. And I think, and we know that there's a higher, purchase of a firearm is linked to suicide. And so, and especially for people who are just in that initial purchase phase. And so, and we think there's a real value to all those pieces I just mentioned. And here's the interesting, we poll about this. In states with firearm purchaser licensing, gun owners support it at a higher rate than those in states that don't have it, which means the process is actually pretty clear, easy, and transparent. And once you're in it, and once you realize that this really isn't going to, if I'm a law-abiding gun owner or want to buy a gun, it's not going to impede me. It's going to weed out people who should not have access to firearms. And just one last thing, there's been a lot of discussion about the Second Amendment in the press and the court recently, but the Fourth Circuit, which is the circuit that I believe covers certainly Virginia, I think North Carolina as well, just recently upheld a firearm purchaser licensing law, again, Maryland's law against a challenge. So we think we're both really in good grounds on the public health side of on the data, but also with the Second Amendment. We feel this is a very strong policy, which is why it's really the number one thing we recommend if you could do one thing.
So those the states that have the purchaser licensing laws, that doesn't apply to like people that might want to purchase at gun shows?
Oh, it does. It applies to
everybody. Oh, it does. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's a big portion of this. So there are states that have that North Carolina is one of those where you have a gun show and there are people who are, I will say, quote unquote, selling from their private collections, but they sell firearms every single weekend at a different gun show. But they are often outside of the background check system. And we don't think that makes any sense. If you're trying to avoid a background check, you will just go to a dealer who doesn't do that, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't make a lot of sense. But I want to make it clear, it's not just that everybody needs to do a background check. It's everybody needs to do the background check that's included in the firearm purchaser licensing law, because that gives the background check system teeth. It makes it enforceable.
There's a section on the center's website titled Safe Storage Saves Lives, and you've talked a bit about this. And there's some heart-wrenching stories of parents who lost their children to guns that weren't secured. Can you talk about that aspect of the center's work?
It's a very important piece of our work. And one thing I maybe haven't mentioned is that in addition to the teams that I mentioned, we have a clinical practices team. And those are physicians who work in the hospital, led by Dr. Catherine Hoops, who work on educating patients about storage, about issues around risks of gun violence. And they have done a lot of work in the field distributing safe storage devices. And our research shows that that states that have better, more enforceable safe storage laws and have better results, reduce gun violence, reduce suicide, accidental death, guns being stolen in trafficking. So the safe storage actually has numerous aspects. We often think, I just don't want kids to get guns, which is great. That's part of it. But it also reduces suicide, can prevent access to someone who's suicidal, and firearm trafficking as well. Those are mechanisms. So locking your firearms are very important. If you go to Every Gun Every Time, you'll see that's the name of our website that we did. We create a lot of materials for Gun Violence Awareness Month in June. And there's great downloadable materials to educate, if you're a gun owner, to educate yourself about why safe storage matters. But also, where do I get a firearms lock? And we at the center, we give out hundreds and hundreds of locks. We give out cable locks. We give out biometric safes. We give out, if you feel you must drive with your gun, we have safes for your car, right? And we know, by the way, that guns stolen from cars are a driving mechanism of criminality down the road. So if you do have to have your firearm in your car, you must lock it, especially if you're not in the car. And that's not in the glove box. That's in the safe, right? And these are inexpensive devices, but safe storage saves lives. And that's why we say lock every gun every time. And that's why we named our, for this campaign, that's the name of the website. And you can get a lot of information about how to talk to people about it. And that's actually a point where there's a great opportunity for what we call public health education, where you can talk to your family members, you can talk to your neighbors and give them, look at the information that we have on the website. And you can use that to start conversations and say, hey, if my kid's coming to your house, are you storing your guns properly? Not judgmental, but saying, here's an opportunity to find some safe storage devices. So I just want to make it clear that for every person who owns a firearm out there, please lock your guns. And for everybody who lives with firearm owners or interacts with them, everybody should do this. It's just so much common sense. And when, for people who are worried about, I need my firearm, what about access quickly? These biometric safes are incredible, absolutely incredible. And you just put your thumb on it and it pops right up. It's really, and they're not expensive. So, and you can probably find a place that's given out for free. I know it at our hospital, we do that. And we're really proud of that work.
You know, Josh, one of the things that still unnerves me, and this happened a couple of weeks ago, I don't know if it was somebody I was talking to or met in town or something, but they had a gun on their, in a holster on their belt. And I'm so unaware of open carry laws, but I just assume that North Carolina has that kind of law. But I guess that's probably a law in many states, isn't it?
Oh, sure. Sure. My home state, we see it all the time. Many gun owners, most gun owners are law abiding. But when you see someone with a gun in their hip, you're not really sure what their intent is. And you also have no idea whether, what kind of mood they're in, right? Or are they aggressive? You know, there's a lot of, you know, you see some of the data. You asked me about mental health earlier. There are anger disorders where people are just angry. I'll use the pun, triggered at any time. And just, you just don't know. So yeah, most times it's going to be safe, but it can be very unnerving, especially for people you don't know. Years ago, you could bring your gun into the Virginia General Assembly. And I remember being in the building and people are carrying guns around and you just don't, you know, just thinking this doesn't make a ton of sense. Fortunately, Virginia has changed that, but out in the street, you'll see that. And like I said, most people are not there to harm, you know, they're carrying guns in self-defense. But you just don't know. And that's why it's unnerving. And of course, also, you know, in many states you can carry publicly, you can carry an assault weapon, an AR-15. And again, you just don't know the intent. And so it makes it uncomfortable to be around that. And I think, you know, from a public health perspective and from just a pure democracy perspective, when you see someone like that, someone carrying a gun at a ballot site or at a town hall meeting, it can really chill people's rights. And it's hard to understand it's hard to understand people's intent on that. I'm just not in favor of it for those reasons. But mostly from my perspective, it can be a very anti-democratic effect if people are carrying guns near a legislative building, in a legislative building, at a ballot location. It can have a chilling effect. And I think that affects people's rights. And we know from survey work that, McNair, just as you said, people don't know what the intent of when they see a firearm on someone's hip. And you'd be, you know, right now, when you think about, obviously there's been lots of high profile and low profile mass shootings over the years and public shootings and random shootings, and you just don't know. And so that's why, you know, I think from both a democratic and a public health perspective, democracy perspective and a public health perspective, it's not a good idea.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And our guest today is Josh Horowitz, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. And we'll be back with Josh in just a couple of minutes after this break.
This is a really sad, sad case. One kid is dead, and another kid is charged in that murder.
Stop the violence.
stop the violence.
When a 15-year-old murders a 15-year-old, is this tragedy multiplied geometrically? It's just this horrifying.
But the gun violence continues.
Police say it was in front of the store that a 17-year-old was shot in the lower leg.
Police are dealing with even more gunfire on another
to paraphrase Dr. King, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere, and that's why you should care. We gotta try to be the change we wanna see. Inspire, motivate, create a new mentality. It's time to make a change. Wake up, no hit ensues. Our kids have killed each other, now how many will we lose? How many have to die? How often will you cry? How many wakes will it take before you do what's best for you and I? T.Y. as I thank you in advance. We gotta work together, gotta give our kids a chance. A real chance, not like brothers on TV. Opportunity should be the new reality. Where are the role models? Who should they look up to? Recognize the problem if you can't say you. Each and every one of us, we all make choices, and actions speak louder than voices. Voices.
The mayor, the police chief, and members of the community spoke out against gun violence again earlier today. And tonight, a teenager was shot in the...
Stop the violence. Stop the violence.
He used a gun that was hidden in an area where people in the neighborhood would use it and then put it back. Someone fired a gun and meant to hit someone else, but this little girl was hit instead.
She was only 10 years old, outside having fun, killed with what they called a community gun. Allegedly the teen was shooting at another. Communities are grieving with the mother. Can we say enough's enough? Is it time to break the silence?
Okay, welcome back. That song is Stop the Violence. And our guest today on A Better World is Josh Horowitz, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Josh, I recently read on the website for the Rockefeller Institute for Government, and it was comparing the U.S. with 35 other economically and politically comparable countries. And I guess I wasn't surprised that the U.S. led these other countries in the number of mass shootings between, I think it was 2000 and 2022. But I was surprised by how much we led. The United States, it said, makes up 33% of the combined population of these 36 countries. However, it accounts for 76% of the public mass shooting incidents and 70% of victim fatalities. I think there were like 109 public mass shootings in the U.S. during that time and 35 mass shootings in 35 other countries. I'm sure you live with these sorts of statistics all the time, but I wonder if the average citizen is aware, and just seems like there should be more of a public outcry about this.
Well, America has a unique relationship with firearms. We have more firearms than all these countries, maybe even combined. We have much higher death rates. We have, and we, you know, thinking about it, is guns are the most lethal of means. If you don't have access to firearms, you can try to, for instance, you know, die by suicide from a different method, which is much less likely to be successful. You can try to attack somebody in a public place. Look, there are terrible incidents with knives and machetes and things, but nothing like what happens in the United States. So I think it's a very salient point to compare ourselves to other countries. However, you don't need to go that far. You just need to look at what's going on in the United States. And if you look at, we do this, you know, on this report that I mentioned, the CDC data from 2024, and you can see a giant, you know, giant variation within the United States. And so you can have states like Hawaii and Massachusetts and New Jersey with gun violence under, the gun deaths under, well under 5 per 100,000. And then you can have a state like Mississippi that's, you know, over, you know, it's like 10 times higher than that, right? And so you don't need to go very far to see that strong gun laws in Hawaii and Massachusetts or North Carolina, I'm sorry, in New Jersey, make a big impact, while states that have very little regulation have very high rates of both gun homicide and gun suicide. And I'm sorry to report, but North Carolina, again, is well above the national average and is about 14 per 100,000. And so you don't need to go that far. You just need to go and look what the how we regulate firearms, how we deal with firearms in the United States, and compare those states to one another. And I I ask people to go look at this report. I think it's really eye-opening, and we have a great chart on page 9 that looks at all the different states, and the variety, the level of gun death is stark just between states in the United States.
That same report also said that the greatest number of incidents occurred in 2019 and 2020 in the U.S. Was that have some relationship to COVID?
2020, we saw a huge increase in gun homicide. And the suicide rate has actually been going up over time. But we saw a big relationship with gun homicide. And fortunately, in many states, those numbers peaked in 20 or 21, 2022, and have been coming slowly down over time, which is fantastic. But I think, you know, COVID, we saw large, large spikes in gun ownership. Probably many people who had never had a firearm before, maybe didn't know a lot about safe storage. You know, I don't have the data on this, but I'm assuming that means gun theft goes up and things like that. Gun access certainly went up. And so you saw more homicide more suicide. The other piece that's important to note in this equation, not only were gun sales going up, but ghost gun sales were going up at the same time dramatically. And for people who don't know what a ghost gun is, ghost guns are kits that people buy with all the parts necessary to construct a firearm, and they're about 80% complete. And then you can get the instructions either from the company that you bought it from or online to complete that. And they actually make very functional firearms. And those guns, remember all the stuff I said about background checks and gun serialization and firearm purchase or licensing, those ghost guns don't go through any of that because the people selling them, and you can buy them online, people like underage kids were getting lots of these things, are quote unquote not selling firearms. They're selling kits. Well, that was dealt with in a federal regulation. Many states have started regulating ghost guns. And I know that in Baltimore, for instance, we saw, you know, during this time period, gun sales rise, huge amounts of ghost guns being recovered in crime. And that has because of better regulation and also litigation, a number of these sellers have been sued, has reduced the flow of ghost guns. We think that's an important feature as well. That's something we want to tease out from the data as we get more of it. But we do think gun sales go up, ghost gun sales go up, lots more access to firearms equals more death.
Where are people getting these devices that allow them to, I don't know what the terminology for it, but increase the number of rounds that can be shot from a gun to make it from a rifle into a, you know, an automatic type weapon?
Yeah. So these are you can buy these things online. They're not regulated. Mm-hmm. In most states, they're poorly regulated. They're easy to find. And sometimes even easy to make with 3D printing. So we need to really focus on that, because we are talking about things like Glock switches that make it easier to convert a semi-automatic weapon into a fully automatic weapon. What I think is problematic is that the manufacturers themselves could do something about this. They could make it harder to do that, but they don't. Remember, we have very little firearm regulation in the United States. The ATF, Consumer Product Safety Commission, very limited regulatory authority. And even when they do use it, they have it, they don't use it. Gun manufacturers have consistently manufactured for not for safety, but increased lethality. And I think that's something that we need to, you know, that you're just seeing more and more lethal weapons, easier to convert these things. That doesn't make any sense. And I think, you know, we need gun manufacturers as well to step up and play their role. And I think they could. And obviously, many of them are not doing that right now. And I think, you know, and obviously there's other nefarious actors who are taking advantage of that. Mm-hmm. But it's just not hard to get these types of enhancements.
You talked earlier about the progress that has been made in the state of Virginia for gun laws. Have we made any progress, do you think, as a country in trying to improve conditions or move the gun debate forward?
Well, I think this, you know, after the terrible shooting in Uvalde and after the terrible shooting in Buffalo, Congress came together to in a bipartisan manner to create the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. And in that act, they provided lots of money for community mental health. They provided lots of money for community violence interruption. We haven't talked about that, but we should. Community violence interruption puts people who are from these communities you know, as paid workers to intervene, to understand the dynamics. They're called credible messengers, and they're often in the community, you know, mitigating violence, trying to understand where, like, it, try to understand where retaliation may come in, trying to get people into programs and services and housing. These are very important programs. So there's a lot of money for CVI in the bill. There was a lot of money. There was a grant program for states to do extreme risk protection order implementation, ERPO laws, which I can talk about in a second. And there was also some enhanced ability. It's the first time ever that there's created a federal firearm trafficking offense, not just lying on paperwork, but actually an offense, a criminal offense of firearms trafficking. It changed the way we think about who's a licensed dealer. It made people who would in the past say, oh, I just sell guns on the weekend, many of them would have to get licenses, which means, as we talked about, that they would have to do the background check, right? And so that country came together in 2022 and made a big impact on that. Unfortunately, many of that has been unraveled by the current administration. So we've seen the money for community violence intervention been cut. We've seen the money for mental health clinics be cut. We've seen enforcement efforts reduced. We've seen an effort to go back to the former definition of who is a dealer. So some of those impacts have been, you know, that moment we came together and said, we're going to do something. And, you know, I think we got 13, you know, most Democrats and over a dozen Republican senators to come together to pass something. That moment, unfortunately, is gone. And now we're seeing rollbacks of those things. So Congress is going, I think, in the wrong way. And that's unfortunate. I'm an optimist, and I think there's a chance in the future that Congress will rebound on that. But right now, you know, if you look at what the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is doing, there's all these new proposed rules, which basically make it easier for people to get firearms. They're changing the way the enforcement's working. So things are going in the wrong direction. We'll see how that affects the data going down the road.
I know this next question is a political question, and from what I gather from what you said earlier, it's not something the center tends to get involved in. But do you ever get asked by legislators, either at state or national level, to offer insight about the usefulness of the Second Amendment?
Oh, well, we have to deal with the Second Amendment all the time. I mean, because it's when you think about all the laws that we've passed or some of the proposals we have, you have to think about the constitutionality of those, and you have to think about. You know, we since the Heller decision in 2008 and the evolution since then, you've seen, you know, the Second Amendment having more teeth than it has in the past. So you have to see, we have to really understand that. And we are often asked, is this law constitutional, right? Will this law pass the Second Amendment scrutiny? And the answer, you know, it's important. So we have a legal team that spends a fair amount of time thinking about that. And in our individual capacities, sometimes we're asked to help with an amicus brief, to bring public health facts into the conversation about the Second Amendment. And we're happy to do that. So yes, we're very abreast of that, and we're involved in that discussion.
That's Josh Horwitz. He's our guest today on A Better World. He's the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence at Johns Hopkins University. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. But we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate. And to discriminate only generates hate. And when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness is what you demonstrate. And that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love just to set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love, y'all.
People killing, people dying, children hurt and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach and what you turn the...
Okay, that's Black Eyed Peas singing Where's the Love from their album, Elephant. And our guest today on A Better World is Josh Horwitz, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. Josh, you had mentioned about what I think is commonly known as the red flag laws, and the Center for Gun Violence Solution is involved in that. Can you talk about what you do with that?
Yeah. So just so your listeners know, a red flag law or extremist protection order is a law that allows mostly law enforcement or sometimes family members, sometimes clinicians, depending on the state, to seek a temporary civil protection order. And in that order, it will ask the court to make a finding that someone, it could be someone interacting with law enforcement or a family member, if it's a civilian petitioner, is at risk of harm to self or others. And the judge will make a decision. It's a two-part order. First, they'll make a decision basically saying, okay, do we have a problem immediately? That's a temporary order. And if so, let's order the gun firearms to be removed for a period between 7 and 14 days. And then secondly, there's a what we call a permanent order, but it's really a year or a final order. It's a final order. And that can last anywhere from most states, it's about a year, where a firearm, the person subject to the order cannot have access to a firearm. So it's a civil protection order, a temporary restriction on firearm rights. You can't have a firearm, can't purchase firearms. It only lasts a year. Okay. They can be extended, but also there's a feature of the law that for every order, every person, what's called a respondent, who's subject to an order, they have the right to come back to court at least once during that year and challenge that and say, hey, whatever was driving my tendencies, I've got treatment. It can be, I'm in a better place, and you can show the judge that you're in a better place. But the order expires after a year. We did this because when you think about some of these mass shootings and you think about suicide, oftentimes people who shouldn't have access to firearms have access. You think about the shooter at Sandy Hook. That's somebody who should never have access. You see somebody in the midst of a mental health crisis should not have access to firearms. People, you know, another big driver of gun violence is alcohol abuse. People who are abusing alcohol may be involved in violence. I mean, one of the biggest predictors of future violence is past violence. And then you add alcohol abuse on top of that, you have someone who could be quite risky. That doesn't mean those things won't abate over time. And so we really think that this temporary nature, getting the guns out of the most lethal means out of people's hands, even temporarily, saves lives. And we think the data is starting to come together to show that. So at our center, we have a lot of information about that, but we train people all over the country. We work to say, like, if you have this law, here's how you implement it properly. Okay. Here's how you implement it in a way that's consistent with the Second Amendment, with consistent with due process, but also make sure that people who are really in crisis, people who are really in need, don't have access to the most lethal means when they're at the height of their crisis. And I think that's something that we're really proud of. You know, when we started this effort, there was a few states that do it. Now there's 22 states, the District of Columbia and the Virgin Islands, who have an IRPA or red flag law. And all those places need to have those laws implemented. People need to be educated. How do you do this? These laws don't self-execute. Judges don't immediately become experts in them. And law enforcement doesn't immediately know when and when not to file. And when not to file is important as well, right? So we do a lot of education around that. Real proud of that work. It's been an important part of our portfolio of work over the last several years.
We're getting near the end of the show. Just a few more questions I wanted to ask you. You know, when I look at things like mass shooting and how they're covered in the media and then other killings and homicides and suicides, it seems like after a certain amount of time that those events pass, that I don't know if apathy is the right word, but it seems like a certain amount of apathy sets in. People forget about what's happened and the importance of it. How can we in this country, can a movement to address this issue be sustained where people aren't apathetic and we make real change?
Well, I think, first of all, I understand that. It seems inevitable, right? And this is just America and this is the way things happen. But I'm an optimist. And when I look at the chart on page 9 of our report, and I hope your readers go there, you will see an optimistic story in many states. You will see states that over time, their gun violence has gone down. You will see states that have markedly less gun violence than other states. Why is that? Now, it's gun laws make a big difference, but also states that have, you know, you can think about some of the social supports that we talked about, more access to mental health, better access to education. All those things come together and they all matter. right? But if you think about things that can change, gun laws are something that can change. We've seen dramatic changes in state gun laws over the last 10 years. So I every death pains me. Every time I see this, I just feel like, wow, how we fail. How do we fail there? You know, let's understand what happened there. But I also, when I take a step back, I say there are, it's hard to show who wasn't, who, you know, the data that shows who hasn't died. But I think there's been some good studies showing that the things that we're doing are reducing gun violence. And, you know, there are many, many people who are alive today because of the work, not just that my center does, but the, all the grassroots advocates across the country who every day write letters, show up, use our data, get out there and make a stink about things. And so there's a, I think there's, you know, there's a movement for change here. It's out there. And, you know, just to go back to one moment, after the shootings of Sandy Hook and after Congress failed to act, people thought, oh, this is a, not only is it a tragedy, but gun violence is never going anywhere. All the people that were outraged, many of them have gotten together, have organized in their local communities, joined other gun violence prevention groups, whatever it is. And they were, the. I do an analysis for my a class that I guest lecture in, and I talk about, you know, what the movements look, what does the gun violence prevention movement look like, and how has it changed over time? More advocates, more money spent on all sorts of pieces of this, and you've, and really a powerful movement was created after 2012 when Sandy Hook was occurred. Virginia Tech, that's what I was thinking of. But all these tragedies have come together actually to get people really outraged and create a movement. So if you're out there and you're outraged, but you're not doing anything, you want to get involved, you can join the local chapter of, there's lots of different organizations out there. There's the Brady Campaign, there's Giffords, there's Moms Demand Action. I mean, and of course, you can support the center, right? So there's lots of opportunities to get involved. And as painful as each of these events are, don't let it fade into the distance. Take action, get involved, make your voice heard.
I'm glad you shared that. I have to admit, entering into the interview, I'm a bit discouraged because of the recent events here in Asheville. So, and you know, you hear so much in the news about the divisive political climate at the federal level that we have, and I just think, gosh, can anything ever be done? So I appreciate you sharing that. Gives me hope.
Well, it should. I mean, you, when you think about states that have made real progress, there are states that in the, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, you'd have thought were impossible. So New Mexico has much better laws. Nevada has better laws. Colorado, Minnesota, Michigan, not just East Coast to West Coast, but states are trying to make a difference. It's still slow going. There's still way too many gun deaths. But from a place of like, can I make a difference? Can we change things? Absolutely.
So give us the web address of the center one more time.
Just Google Center for Gun Violence Solutions. That will take you to all this information. And if you're interested specifically in safe storage, you can go to Every Gun Every Time. But those are the two gateways, if you will, to come into the work that we've been doing.
Any last thoughts you'd like to share?
I know that Asheville is mourning. I'm sorry for the violence that's affected Asheville. I know that there are community groups will be looking at this and legislators will be looking at this. Make sure you have all the right data. We're happy to provide that. Look at our website. But I hope, as painful as this is, it's an opportunity for the community to come together and think together is an opportunity for how do we make sure this doesn't happen in the future. And I'm sorry that your community has gone through this. But I'm optimistic that you can find solutions moving forward.
And on that note, I want to thank Josh Horowitz, the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions at Johns Hopkins University. Josh, thank you so much for coming on the show, and all the best to you. And thank you for the work that you and the others do at the Center for Gun Violence Solutions.
You're welcome, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk today.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with the L&M Project Band singing Throw Down Your Guns.
We all want a world of peace, but the politicians want the power to deceive.
brothers and sisters are dying all the time.